Behavioral Health Today, a podcast by Triad Behavioral Health, covering trending topics in behavioral and mental health. This podcast is designed to share unique and relevant topics occurring within the world and our communities and bring them a mental health perspective. Today's topic area is part of our Clinician Series podcast. In our regular podcast, we provide the coverage of a mental health topic of interest, and we find ourselves typically focused on the why behind or the why that drives the work being done in a specific area. The Clinician Series, however, is taking the discussion of topic areas a few steps further, specifically talking with experts not just about the why of their area of expertise, but we'll dive into a more practical, more hands-on, experiential understanding of the what and the how regarding the application of various therapeutic techniques, strategies, and constructs that we'll be presenting. The goal of the Clinician Series is to take our listeners behind the therapy door, to provide a look at and develop an appreciation for what actually occurs in the therapy session, including what gets said, patients' reactions, and the dynamic between the therapist-patient that can occur during the therapy hour.
Welcome to Behavioral Health Today. I'm your host, Dr. Graham Taylor, and with me today is Dr. Jana Martin and Dr. Lydia Mitchell. Jana is a CEO of the American Insurance Trust. Her clinical experience includes work in hospitals and mental health clinics. Jana has conducted numerous trainings and workshops, as well as having involvement in an independent practice. Jana has been commended by the American Psychological Association with a Presidential Citation for exemplary work as a modern-day practitioner, and is a recipient of the Rosalie G. Weiss Award for Outstanding Leaders in the Psychology from the American Psychological Foundation. Lydia is a bilingual licensed psychologist dedicated to community mental health field. She has focused her career on the treatment of children and adolescents with special expertise in infant mental health, working with children 0 to 5 years old. She is also involved with the training and supervision of psychologists, the advancement of multicultural competency, individual and family therapy, and psychological assessment. Lydia is also presented to adults, parents, mental health providers, crisis workers, and graduate students. Both Jana and Lydia have been on our podcast before, and it is terrific to have them both back. Jana, Lydia, thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure.
Thanks for having me back.
Great to have you both here. You know, today we're addressing vicarious trauma, and we'll be doing so as part of our Clinicians series. The goal of the Clinician series through our podcast is to take folks behind the therapy door, to provide a look at and develop an appreciation for what actually occurs in the therapy session and what the therapist experiences within the therapeutic relationship and also within the therapeutic process. As we come into our topic today, we're talking about vicarious trauma. We get to acknowledge that often part of our work requires us to listen to and sit with and to hold with our patients their stories of significant challenge at times, maybe traumas they've gone through and very distressing, often painful, often unthinkable and profoundly sad experiences as part of the work. It's a big ask professionally, I believe, but it's part of what the therapeutic commitment is really all about and what we've agreed to do as practitioners in order to help folks through these life experiences that are preventing them from experiencing their fullest possible life. But there's a cost to this for therapists, as there can be an accumulative and a lasting impact on the practitioner. And that's what we want to talk about today. And as we come in our talk today, I'd like to just ask Jana, can you kind of tease apart for us and define vicarious trauma? Because oftentimes it kind of gets bundled in with compassion fatigue, secondary trauma. So with regard to vicarious trauma, distinguish that for us and maybe define that part for us, if you would, please.
Oh, certainly. I'd be happy to. You know, sometimes vicarious traumatization is described as catching the trauma of those that one is helping. And certainly, one of the prerequisites is that the patient has experienced some traumatic experience. It is the more serious form of the other terms with which it is likely grouped, because one of the things that is critically different is that with vicarious trauma, in addition to the caregiver, provider, mental health practitioner experiencing some of the same symptoms that the patient has,
right,
in vicarious trauma, the caregivers also suffer a shift in their worldview.
Yes.
The impact on them is at a very deep level. their inner experience is changed, it's transformed. So in simplistic terms, one could go from being optimistic to being pessimistic,
yes,
or from feeling secure and in control to emotional states of helplessness, hopelessness, and despair.
Really good. Yeah, that part of it where vicariously we take on, kind of in a parallel process way, the changes in our view of self, others, the world. Lydia, what are some of your thoughts as we're talking about just kind of setting the cornerstone about vicarious trauma being a very unique experience in therapy?
Sure. I think it's most similar to probably what I would call like trauma exposure response. And it's sort of the way that our mind copes with the information that maybe began as something helpful and then turns into something maladaptive. I think a lot about, as you were talking, Janet, the similarity between like when external reality becomes our internal reality of when we begin engaging in the ways that our clients may have. And you talked about pessimism. I think about cynicism, anger. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the concepts are really similar.
Yeah. What you're talking about is the process of experiencing those. It comes from an empathic connection and an empathic component in the work itself. So we know that empathy and validating another's suffering does in fact make the clinician vulnerable within that therapeutic process. In fact, part of the healing process involves us as practitioners holding that trauma until the patient can take parts of that back and reintegrate that into their lives in a manner where this not as disturbing and less traumatic for them to kind of hold and journey with that, you know, in their future. What do we know about that empathic process, including holding the trauma and even maybe even the neurophysiological parts of empathy?
Well, one of the things that I think is very fascinating and helpful to think about is a lot of times people confuse empathy with compassion. And in some senses, empathy is a part of compassion.
Yeah.
But one way that I like to look at it is to view compassion as sociocognitive. It's the ability to feel for someone, but with a screen. Some kind of an internal boundary that protects us in some way. Whereas empathy is socioaffective. It's the ability to feel with someone. Mm-hmm. But if there's no screen in place or there's emotional dysregulation, then the clinician can feel overwhelmed in taking on the symptoms of the client.
Right.
When you look at the neurological components, this is where I get kind of geeky and fascinated with some of the components, because when you look at compassion and empathy, they're actually two very different responses on a neural level. Each activates very different independent brain networks. Hoffmeyer in 2020 and his colleagues were very sentinel in bringing forward some of this research. Neuroimaging studies show that the areas that are activated by empathy, so we're going to talk about empathy for just a minute, include the anterior medial cingulate cortex and the anterior insula, but it's driven by what's known as mirror neurons.
Yes.
I'm fascinated by mirror neurons. They were actually discovered accidentally, kind of sounds like Pavlovian discoveries, doesn't it? But they were discovered accidentally when research were studying grasping behavior in monkeys. Mm. They were investigating which neurons fired when a monkey reached out to grasp a raisin. They noticed during a break that neurons in the monkey's brain lit up when a researcher reached to grasp the raisin. So the same neurons activated by performing an action are also activated by seeing the action.
Experiencing it.
So what that means is that empathic experiences are caused by activation of similar neural networks that are shared by another individual. So empathic experiences relate to first person experiences in terms of neuroimaging. So when we empathize with someone who's in pain, our brains as the caregivers, the clinicians, will show activation of similar circuits as the brain of the person with whom we are empathizing, which I think is fascinating and certainly adds great emphasis to how thin that boundary can be at times and how important it is to have that self-other distinction so that you don't get swallowed up in this. One of the common experiences that everyone can probably relate to that's mediated by mirror neurons is yawning. Have you ever been in that situation where you don't feel like yawning at all, but somebody with you yawns, and then suddenly you're yawning too? It's a similar, it's kind of catching again that situation. So that's empathy. When you look at compassion, compassion activates the medial orbitofrontal cortex and the ventral striatum. And those are parts of the brain that are linked to reward and affiliation processing with receptors that stimulate positive affect towards those we are suffering. That is why when we have people who are really in vicarious traumatization states and phases, training them in compassion is actually a protective and healing mechanism, because compassion activates networks that provide a protective action from stress.
Really good.
So the neural studies show that exposure to the distress and suffering of others activates these two different reactions, and the difference is often due to emotional regulation. Again, that self-other distinction. If that's blurred, we absorb another's pain and trauma and negative emotions, and we suffer what's become the common term now is empathic distress fatigue, which can trigger our own neurological downfall and response.
Really good. I love this part you're contributing here. Lita, I want to get your thoughts on this as well, but we're really validating here that there is something literally occurring that we may not be aware of, and we necessarily can't measure without some of the things you're describing, you know, in terms of instruments measuring this, but there's real changes taking place, real experiences occurring in that mirroring way that are impacting us. But we get to raise it, not just validate it, but get to raise it to an awareness now and talk about how we can think about this and what we can do about this. Lydia, I know that in your work, you talk about trauma stewardship, but I'd like to talk about what your thoughts are about how we're taking this on and how we can catch this through that empathic listening to story after story of human suffering. What are your thoughts?
I actually think it fits in perfectly with trauma stewardship, because trauma stewardship is about engaging in the work that's intentional, mindful, present, but not taking on our clients' troubles and struggles as our own. So that distinction between, self and other is key. You know, as you were talking, Janet, I was just thinking about when we're first beginning training and when we're really learning about how to do therapy and theoretical concepts. And I think we often misunderstand that we don't necessarily need to join and sort of like bathe in empathy of what our clients are telling us. Like, that's important data, absolutely. But remembering that there is a distinction between the therapist and the client is also important. I just think about, you know, being a really relational therapist and thinking like, oh, this is my way to know what's happening with this person. But forgetting that second step of this isn't my experience. I think too, you know, your thoughts about mirror neurons, I just kept thinking about co-regulation. And how that's a huge part of the therapeutic relationship and a part of what we try to teach our parents too, that because of mirror neurons, you're going to feel what your client feels. And as a parent, you're going to feel what your child feels. But how you return the response also impacts the other person. And so when we're present and regulated, then it gives your client an opportunity to match you. And to be present with emotion without becoming overwhelmed by it. Those are just some of the ideas that I was sitting here listening to you. I was like, oh, this and that. Yes.
Right. Well, and to your point too, you know, there's also somatic therapy. Many times we will mimic the posture Absolutely. Of our clients. Mm-hmm. And we know when we work with people, for example, who are very anxious, maybe have panic disorder, if they are experiencing some breathing difficulties during a session because they're becoming panicked, what do? We model appropriate breathing.
Right.
We slow our breathing down. And it's not always because we do it consciously.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It's because we are well-trained, but we also understand that mirror neurons work in both directions.
Yes.
And so it's important for us to present that, because if we're being self-aware of how we are picking up on the trauma or the panic or whatever it is, and we are trying to keep ourselves from being sucked up into it, then we engage in this techniques and strategies that we would inform our patients or clients to do as well.
Yes.
And I think one other comment to something you mentioned, one of the most valuable things that I learned when I was being trained was that understanding someone's pain does not require that you feel it.
Yes. Hmm. That you take it on.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's difficult, I think, to hear, because I think about just different theories and ways of working. I think what's been helpful to me in my own practice is to see feeling as data of like, oh, this is what it's like, and to understand it almost like from a bird's eye view. Sure. I think that gives it some of like, oh, this is what it's like to walk in their shoes. And this is, how can I speak to this experience? Where do I feel it in my own body? And it's sort of like, is this idea of like affect being contagious, but then how can we notice it, hold it up and look at it together, and then return it to its rightful owner?
Mm-hmm. I think that modeling piece in that is a really good reminder that while they are going through a difficult time in a session, even, we get to model something back that they begin to internalize. It's that mirroring taking place, going back. And you're saying a great point, Lydia. I can join them in that feeling, and I can hold that feeling and set of experiences with them without taking it on. And in fact, taking it on can actually be detrimental, because I can become in kind of an impaired provider, right? That they don't need me to take it on to feel like they can trust me or to know that I'm joining them in that place.
Yeah.
But I can hold that with them until they can begin to kind of carry it in ways that are, like I said earlier, aren't so disturbing or interfering in their lives. But to take it on, and sometimes, like you said, early in our careers, we got to take it on and feel it to the same degree, actually is not in the service of good therapy taking place.
Well, I think everyone starts out at different points, right? I think for me, it was was definitely one to take it on. And I think others start off with a lot of distance and like, oh, I don't want to touch that. So we all, I think having, you know, meeting somewhere in the middle and, you know, tolerating affect, such a big part of becoming a therapist.
I think that what we're saying is that feeling what it feels like to you is where you have that self-other distinction. What the differentiation is, you don't have to feel it exactly the same way. You don't have to absorb it. You don't have to swallow it and take it away. You want to find ways to help them master it.
Yes.
And empower them to understand that it can be mastered and dealt with. So feeling, yes, you want to feel it, but you want to feel it as the observer rather than totally meshing with that patient.
My hope in this podcast today is for our colleagues that are practitioners in mental health field, but also those, you know, in the ERs, the first responders. This applies to all of those folks who are coming face to face with trauma, an event outside the realm of normal experience. And our brains don't have kind of a context or meaning understanding to process some of these things. And the way that we process them is doing what we're doing right now as colleagues, putting some context to it, putting some meaning to it, inviting conversations around it when you're going through it, so we get to carry it in the healthiest possible way. Let me take that and just shift just a wee bit. I want to talk about some of the warning signs that we can become aware of. Jen, you talk about some of the warning signs and
sure.
the symptoms of vicarious trauma. Share those with us.
Sure. So certainly, because we talked about how vicarious trauma involves a shift, sometimes you as the clinician may not be as aware of it as those around you, because it's on a spectrum. It's on a continuum. It's not like you got a bunch of it or you got none of it. You know, it's on a continuum. It's a spectrum. And so it can creep. And if you aren't aware of what those beginning signs are, so I'll tell you what some of them are. Losing your passion for something, not putting the energy into it, having thoughts and images that you can't shake, you can't seem to work through them with your own therapist or with a trusted consultation group, you begin to feel inadequate as a caregiver. And you can't draw that line between work and personal life. It all becomes emotionally one continuum, as opposed to there being a start and stop. You might feel some loss of energy. You also might find that you'd rather be by yourself. You begin to cut away from your friends and contacts, people who can help transport you to a place out of the session. And so then that just compounds the being lost and absorbed in the obsession. Of course, you have the usual things that are monitors or signals that something's going wrong, sleep disturbances, difficulty concentrating. You can begin, of course, as we said, obviously, to begin to have the same signs and symptoms that your clients do. I think one of the biggest risks for some clinicians is they begin self-medicating with alcohol or drugs, or they begin to engage in high-risk behaviors because they've lost that sense of, well, what's the use anyway?
Right.
But it does start out for some people just a little bit. Oh, I'm not as excited about, you know, going into work today. Or, wow, I seem really grumpy. I just went from zero to 99 in a second, when usually I'm much better balanced. I have more self-doubt, or I just don't feel like very worthwhile.
Really good. So these are signs, symptoms we can catch early. It is accumulative. And if we can catch these early, we can intervene early. Lydia, in your work, as you're working with folks and kind of holding this, you know, trauma stewardship up, what are some of the additional things that you see that can be helpful for us as practitioners?
Oh, I wanted to just build on too some of the ideas you put forth, Jana, that encouraging folks to ask people who know them well, how have I changed since I started this work? And the idea that other people who know us will be able to recognize some of this even before we do. I would encourage people to ask about anger. How does my anger show up now? And you can reflect on that yourself, but I think sometimes that other really can give us their perspective. I think, too, you were talking about self-medicating with alcohol, and I think there's also a lot of therapists self-medicating with coffee. And just so much coffee. And to maintain this stamina and this sense of urgency. Well, and I mean, we all like coffee, you know, that's okay. We all need to wake up in the morning. But I think, you know, when folks are working super long days and 3-4 cups of coffee in the, and using those to maintain a stamina that isn't sustainable, that you're no longer engaging in a sustainable practice, but sort of pushing and pushing yourself. I think there's a lot of culture around it that says it's okay, but I think it's worth looking at. I think about too, in terms of like addiction, so to speak, in quotes, like the use of TV to disengage, that folks come home and just turn on the TV, and it's also a numbing. It's a way of numbing the way that alcohol might have helped us numb. In terms of other warning signs, I think one that I think a lot about and isn't talked about as much is maybe like disassociation, like moments of disassociation. So I could tell a story of once being so concerned with everything I needed to do and the clients I was going to see and being so ready to just, you know, engage in the work. I'm driving, but I'm not present. I'm not fully with what I'm doing. I pulled over and I grabbed my bag and my things and, you know, I'm off to, you know, be a superhero, be a therapist. And then the security guard is like running after me. And I go, whoa, what is it? And he's like, you left your car door open. These moments of like, oh, I'm, because I'm so connected to the stories of other people and so connected to my work and service, I'm not being fully present with what I'm doing from moment to moment. That's something that I encourage people to think about of, When are you somewhere else? When you're at home or trying to relax, are you still with your clients? That's probably something to look at. Yeah.
Absolutely. It's really good. I want to talk in just a minute or so about some things that we can do for the self-care, but I want to talk about one additional area of consideration. We're talking about some of the warning signs right now that are so good. For me, it's always about early identification, early intervention. You know, we can catch these things early, like on that continuum you're talking about, Jenna, where it doesn't build up to a point where we're having to dig ourselves out of a very difficult hole. But I also know that there are risk factors for us as clinicians that can make some of us more vulnerable to the vicarious traumatization along the way. Things like maybe my own prior traumatic experience that I, even if I've done some work with, it can be triggered. Mm-hmm. Am I practicing, you know, kind of in a solo way where I don't have a lot of connections with my colleagues? What are some risk factors just that we can bring in as clinicians that are ours into the work in trauma?
Well, I think you hit on one of the most important ones, and that is your own personal trauma, your own personal issues. And, you know, we talk a lot in therapy about transference and countertransference, and the countertransference piece is when something that's going on with your therapist brings up something for you. And I recall once having a young woman, she was only 16 years old, and she was brought to the first session by her father. And the reason was that her mother had died. And it had been a very difficult death for her as a young woman. She was an only child. She had some step siblings that were older, but she really was her mother's child. I mean, she's very close to her mother, and not as close. She loved her father, but they didn't do much together. And now here she found herself having to live with a man that she didn't know as well or bonded while she was grieving. Yes. And so as she sobbed and sobbed about the death of her mother, she mentioned the date that her mother died. And it was the exact same date that my father died. And instantly I was transported to my own experiences. It was because of a date. And there are all kinds of things you wouldn't think are going to be the triggers for you, but they can be. So being aware of things that have occurred to you and how they might be triggered in the session. But on that same line, I think it's really important for us to also think about the ethnicity of our clients and our patients, as well as our own, because you talk about long-term unresolved trauma. When you look at racial injustices, pervasive, ongoing trauma, slights, microaggressions, then certainly that can be triggered by an experience of a patient or client. Whether it's a direct match or not doesn't matter. It's if that person is experiencing something that is condescending nature or being discriminated against or overlooked or mistreated because of the way they look, whether it's their weight, their sexual orientation, or their ethnicity. So that's another important personal event that's a little bit of a different kind of trauma. And I think another risk factor is if you're more of an introvert and you're not the kind of person who communicates openly with a lot of people, so you don't have someone who's your share partner that you say, I had a rough day. And while you certainly don't talk about clients with your friend who's not a clinician, that's what consultation groups are for. If you bottle it all up, then you increase the risk that you're going to absorb more and more and more because you're not letting it have an outlet with a therapist or with a colleague or with a consultation group. So poor personal support systems, as well as your inability or your personality of not necessarily being open and sharing, and whatever issues you have around that psychologically, are also high risk factors.
Really good. Lydia, the work you do with teaching and encouraging trauma stewardship, what are some of the risk factors you see and can maybe add to here about clinicians, they themselves, and what they're bringing in, or maybe kind of how they're practicing? What else do you see?
Well, I think this brings me a little bit to the idea of trauma mastery. And I think to just acknowledge how many folks really join the field because they've had their own difficult experiences.
Yes.
I think it's like the untold secret of psychology and marriage and family therapy, social work, or first responders, that there's often sometimes something in our own history that draws us to the work and that draws us to want to help or to cope with, you know, the world's tragedies. And I think it's really important for folks to reflect on that in a non-judgmental way of like, what are my factors? What is it that brought me to the field? And if it was trauma, to just see it for kind of what it is of like, okay, knowing this about myself, the pros, I may have a more intuitive way of knowing, but at the same time, I'm more likely to be flooded.
So there's a real attunement that's unique, a real attunement that's unique, but also maybe the potential for something that can be very overwhelming, maybe even flooding. Yes.
Yeah. And just to know that about yourself and to recognize that. I loved what you were saying about recognizing experiences of people from different backgrounds. I think even for myself of like, what did I choose to work in? You know, I work with Latinx communities. The issues of multicultural competence are really important to me. I'm an immigrant myself. And so in having space for, okay, this is something that I can offer the field. There's very few Latinx or Spanish speaking psychologists. It's a real problem of diversity in our field. And so when those folks are at the table, I think it offers, when we're of those backgrounds, we need to have special care for ourselves and to even see our own self-care as a form of social activism, as a form of honoring the work that we have to care for ourselves in special ways because of our backgrounds.
Yeah. Folks, pardon the interruption, but we'll conclude this discussion in our next episode. I want to thank both of our guests, Jenna Martin and Lydia Mitchell. And we want to thank you as our listeners for tuning in today. And we look forward to having you join us next time on Behavioral Health Today.
Hey, Behavioral Health fans, we want to hear from you. If you have an idea for a show topic that you would like covered in a future episode, go to triedbehavioralhealth.com/behavioral-health-today and click on the Send Us Your Idea button to submit a topic. We appreciate all the support from our community, and if you like our show, one of the best ways you can support it is by giving us a 5-star rating and leaving us a review. Behavioral Health Today is a podcast part of the Tried Behavioral Health Network, all rights reserved.